ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतितां पुराणेन मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्बत्वाम् अनुसन्ततामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वेषिणी. Yatato hyapikanteya purushasya vipaschitaha indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha yatatah hi api kaunteya purushasya vipaschitaha indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha. In the previous verse, Krishna was saying, for the dehi, for the person who's embodied, say if they're fasting, meaning really keeping themselves away from all of the sense objects, even doing that, though they won't be able to enjoy the sense objects, still they can't get rid of the rasa, right? The raga, the desire for it. Right? Unless one has knowledge. If one has knowledge, then the rasa also goes. So now, so that was the verse that we were working on. But now the thing is, for the mumukshu, for the seeker who has viveka, who is very much a part of this, very committed into this process, even for that person, this knowledge, the mind can get carried away. And so this is what we're going to be looking at right now. So in this verse he says very clearly, remember, this is for the vipaschit. So he says, yatataha, he indeed, as we all know in the bhasha, as everybody knows, all of the mumukshus know, all of the jnanis know, all of the people who have been involved in this pursuit, everybody knows. So, what do they know? For the one who is striving, yatataha is the present participle in the sixth case, genitive case. For that one who is striving, hey Kaunteya, hey son of Kunti, his name for Arjuna, hey Kaunteya, purushasya vipaschitaha, for that person, genitive, for that person, api vipaschitaha api, to take the api from the beginning, even for the person who is a viveki, seriously, who has knowledge, who's been exposed to this knowledge, who has viveka, who knows all of these things in the creation are bound by time, very clearly knows that. Even for that person who is making proper efforts, indriyani, the indriyas, which are indriyani pramathini. Pramatha means they are very forceful. They're very, very agitating and confusing. Right? They agitate and they confuse. So these indriyas, means the sense organs backed by the mind. But sense organs without the mind are not functioning. If you're, for instance, we always say if you're looking, your eyes are open and you're staring at something, but your mind is daydreaming, your sense organs are inoperable at that time. So we're not just talking about sense organs by themselves. It's sense organs enlivened by the mind. So really speaking, The desire is something, the desire or what is agitating is something that belongs to the mind. But the mind is hooked to the sense organs, and it is the sense organs that are experiencing the world. The sense organs backed by the mind experiences the world. And so as you are going along experiencing the world, something lights up. If you didn't have any sense organs, it wouldn't light up. So that's why we're blaming the sense organs for this one. So the sense organs that are engaging in the world backed by the mind, they can be be very confusing, very tumultuous. And they with prasabham means with great strength. These sense organs that can be confusing with great strength, haranti manaha, they rob away the mind. They steal the mind. Harati means to kidnap, to capture and run away with the thing. Right? So these sense organs with so much strength can be so agitating, they can rob away the mind, even for the viveki, even for the seeker. Right? And so in the next verse he'll say, therefore we have to learn how to control. Right? But so it's an important verse. It's highlighting the universal situation that every human being finds themselves in. We have lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, as defining the means for our happiness to be the getting rid of certain things and the acquiring of other things. And so we have just in unconscious alone. So currently collected in this life itself, so many raga dveshas, so many likes and dislikes that cause me to say, all right, this type of person makes me happy, this one doesn't. This type of situation makes me happy, this doesn't. On and on and on and on. Very, very refined. You know, it's very refined. Our tastes are very refined. And our commitment to manipulating the creation so that I can have a comfortable situation, which only means comfortable situation could be like, if I think of a comfortable situation, I can think of having a little hut in Rishikesh in the Ganga with no electricity or nothing. That sounds really delightful. Mm. You know? But for another person, their vision of a comfortable situation is it simply depends on what in your mind you have committed to, really committed to, as this is what I need to be happy. This is what I view I need to be happy. And so it's refined, you know. And it covers every layer of your existence. Every layer, every level, every experience. We have something to say about it. And so there's an unwinding that has to take place. Now, why is it that these sense organs are so strong? Well, because the reason is simple, really, is what makes every human being pursue anything is my own wholeness. If I believe that I need this to be happy, then my mind will go there. That's where the mind goes. If you want to trace, you know, where you think your happiness is, just follow your mind. Just follow your sense organs. That's where they're going. Okay? They're going away from the things, running away from the things that are painful and toward the things that will make you happy. And so now, when you bring in a concept, like for the Sadhana Chatushtaya, like the fourfold viveka, vairagya, shama, dhamma, upadhiti, tiksha, that viveka, vairagya is key. What does vairagya mean? Why is vairagya the primary, as we see in the aparokshana bhuti that we're doing on Saturdays, why is vairagya so primary? Because vairagya shows that the viveka has been successful. Vairagya is successful viveka, right, where I recognize that, in fact, this object is not my source of ananda, nor is this one. nor is this one, nor is this one. So as the vairagya increases, in fact, the dark night of the soul for the mumukshu is the one, for the mumukshu is the one that says, "Uh-oh, you know, none of these objects." Say for a mumukshu whose vairagya, whose viveka is mature, and their vairagya is mature, but they don't have knowledge. What is the condition of their mind? The mind goes out; it can't go out to become happy. And because wherever it goes, it'll say, "No, that won't do it. No, that won't do it." And so the poor mind is kind of held in a limbo. But for most of us, our mind kind of knows that. It kind of knows that, but there's a lot of exceptions. Yeah, this is a typical viveki mumukshu. It's, yeah, I know that really the ananda is not here. I know that. I'm clear. But emotionally, emotionally, I want that. So the rasa is, in spite of my knowledge is still at an intellectual level, in a sense. It hasn't integrated down into the reality that the reality that the ananda that I'm seeking is, in fact, equally present in all objects. The ananda I'm seeking is like the graham cracker cookies. It's like the graham cracker in the graham cracker cookies, in the sense that my being is the truth of every single object that exists in the creation, without exception. My being is the truth of every vritti I have in my mind. It's the truth of every perception I have. It's the truth of the whole manifest creation. So like when Swamiji tells the graham cracker cookie story, you know, I want the horse, I don't want the cow. I only want the horse. I don't want the elephant either. I want the horse. We're out of horses. No, I have to have the horse. You gave the horse to Johnny. I want that horse. Johnny, can I have that? On and on it goes. On and on it goes. And it goes that way because we haven't recognized the graham cracker. The Atmakamaha, the one who desires the Atma, think of it in light of this graham cracker story. The Atmakam, that's the Jivanmukta, the one who's liberated. The Atmakamaha is the one who sees the self in the Namarupa. Namarupa, right? Instead of seeing the horse, instead, I'll put it this way. Instead of having a strong desire for the horse or the cow or the elephant or the dog or the cat, your strong desire is for the graham cracker. That's viveka. Now say, think of it like that in terms of this creation. For the one who has, I'm talking about the jnani now, the one who's not having a problem, because this is the one who's got to have a problem. For the jnani, what if I recognize all beings, all situations are only myself? But what am I seeing? I'm seeing the self, not as an object, but as the very being which is the truth of all of the, it's the very truth of all of the situations that I find myself in. And where is that self to be experienced? Say if I say, like for instance, this is something important for recognizing this I am the whole. For how do we recognize I am the whole? Now, if I use the graham cracker story, it's a beautiful story, but it has one, there's a little kink in it. With the graham cracker story, I love the graham cracker. I love the cracker itself. I love the taste of the graham cracker. So for me, truly, that's what I want. I could care less whether it's a horse or whether it's a cow or an elephant. I don't care because my drishti, my vision is on the graham cracker. But in this story, both the graham cracker is an object of perception and the form of the graham cracker is an object of perception. Right? And so that's how we're used to recognizing. So we'll think in reference to this whole creation, gee, if I could just see all of this as myself, In the same way as I can see all of the graham cracker animal crackers as graham cracker, then I would see I am the whole. But the problem is now when I say that, this is just a little subtle thing that can get in our way sometimes. When I say it like that, I want to see all of this as myself, and then, of course, why would I desire this more than this when, you know, I know that I'm the very truth of all of it. But I don't see that. I don't see that because my eyes only see form. My ears only hear sound, right? And so I can see form, and in fact, I can go into this form that I'm seeing, like I'm seeing you and you and you and you, and say if I really want to find the self in it, maybe I can dissect the form. But if I dissect the forms that I'm seeing, then I just see smaller forms. So how on earth can I see that I am the graham cracker of everything that I'm perceiving? How can I have that experience? What is the truth? What is it? Because what will make me know that and have it not just be intellectual? What makes it knowledge and not just an idea? So that I can sit here in this room and say, I am the whole. To do that, to be able to know that, it's like when we did in the meditation today. The invariable of myself has to be recognized as the invariable of all experience that I have. The Dehatma Buddhi is the sense of touch creates a problem for me, creates a problem of my recognizing my being as the invariable self that all beings are enjoying. Because really, if you think about it, this sense of touch that you have right now is right now at this moment giving you the invariable being that you are. It's adding to that the experience of your body. The invariable being, the conscious being that you are, is now being experienced with this body because of your sense of touch. The invariable being that you are is now being experienced with the perception of this room because of your sense of sight. The sense of touch gives the perception of the body. Sense of sight gives the perception of the room. But your invariable being, your presence, your me, the conscious being, is no more distant from this room than it is from this body. The very self-experience that you are is no more distant from the room than it is from the body. If I look up at the solar system, say in a night sky, which is filled with, countless stars, in that perception, the invariable being that I am is the very being which that huge perception enjoys. So what I have to start becoming alert to in my experience, right? Even say, it's exactly the same. Say if we go internally into the emotional system where you look at your feelings and your thoughts, the thought flow that's going on in your mind, all of the feelings and all of the feelings and emotions that you're having. You're the invariable being that you are, is the constant pervasive to those also. There is no exception to it. There's no exception. So it's a matter of recognizing. When I've recognized that invariable being of myself, the constancy of it, the constancy of that self, and I recognize the relationship of my being to the experience of Ananda in the mind. This is where thinking has to take place. If this, what Swamiji talks about this also in his Bhasha on this, if these things aren't thought through, if the mind doesn't understand all of this, there's no way to bring the mind back. It's the understanding of this that allows you to bring the mind back. Okay, so now, if you understand that your being is the one that's present in all perception, in all experience. And that when your mind is at peace, they're calling prasada buddhi here, when the mind is at peace, that mind enjoys a sensation of happiness. When the mind is quiet. The mind is quiet when it's not seeking. The mind is not seeking when it's fulfilled the desire. When things are as I want them to be. The mind is not seeking, let me put it this way, you can say, let's start like this. Your mind is not seeking when it's fulfilled the desire, okay, to start with. Why? Because at that moment that it's fulfilled a desire, it believes that it is happy. Why? It believes it's happy. Because I need this to be happy. I'll explain what I mean by believes, because it is feeling happy. It thinks I need this thing to be happy. I get this thing, and so my mind relaxes because I have just acquired the object of happiness, and so for that moment my mind relaxes, and at that moment I experience happiness, and so of course that experience of happiness is projected onto the object. That's what we do over and over and over again. Say I come into my house and everything is just as I would like it. I walk into a fulfilled desire and my mind relaxes. I am happy. A person smiles at me and just the way I would like he or she to smile at me, my mind relaxes. I am happy. Whatever it is, what has happened is my mind relaxes, so I am happy. The desire is fulfilled in the sense, just as any jiva, your desire is momentarily fulfilled in the sense that at that moment, you don't want anything to be different. You see? So that mind, you don't want anything to be different. That's the prasada buddhi. You enjoy ananda. You enjoy fullness. All is well with me. What is the mind of the jnani like that has recognized that the source of that ananda, which is the very truth of all beings, the very truth of the creation, the source of that ananda is my being. The source of the ananda that I've always sought in terms of nama rupa, in terms of names and forms, I've recognized to be my very being, and that this being is in fact the source of all beings. Say I've recognized that. Say I know it intellectually at least. Say for now, say I recognize it. Okay. Then for the mumukshu, I now desire that self. Or I desire, I can say another way, I desire a mind that doesn't behave in a way, you know, that the mind, a mind that doesn't seek myself out here. The mumukshu. Who understands? Not the mumukshu who doesn't understand. The mumukshu has to know this, that viveka has to be there, that clarity of knowledge has to be there. So the clarity of knowledge is there, then what does the mumukshu want? I want a mind that recognizes the truth of this and doesn't behave as though myself is out here. And so I've had a lifetime of behaving. Lifetimes of behaving as though myself was out here, the ananda that I seek was out here, because that was my understanding. That's what we call mithya jnanam. That's the false understanding. And I've been living off of that false understanding. Now I have a clear understanding. But my mind is still behaving according to that false understanding. And so what do I do? So first Krishna is acknowledging, yes, that's true. The mind has gone lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes based on that false understanding. And so my whole network, all of my neurons, everything that makes me an individual, has been geared towards seeking my happiness, Even seeking my happiness in reference to a state of mind or a certain level of intelligence or a certain level of emotional maturity, trying to become this, trying to become that, trying to be this for other people or that for other people. Because at every single level, it's like that. I'm seeking my peace, my well-being, from manipulating the environment or manipulating my own mind in one way or another. And so now that I'm starting to understand, my mind still continues to behave in the old ways. Krishna is saying, yes, that's right. Because these samskaras have lifetimes of strength behind them, number one, and everybody else is doing the same thing. That's also a problem, you know. And the whole value system is built around that, ajnanam. And so you're kind of alone. Kind of alone in your knowledge. Which is why in fact, in most spiritual traditions, they'll say you need satsang. You know? You need satsang. You need community. You need shravana. You keep doing shravana because as soon as you walk out into a totally different value system. The Gita, Krishna, in one of the verses, he says, you know, what is day to an ajnani is night to a jnani. What is day to a jnani is night to an ajnani. And if you're a mumukshu, so in between there, you are in the minority. You're in the minority. Your vision is in the minority. And so because of that, you need satsang. You need shravana. And you need the tools. You need those tools to be able to pull your mind back. The tools to pull your mind back when it habitually goes out into a behavior or dealing with the type, dealing with the world in a way that the world is not. To when the mind continues to go out and behave in the world in a way the world is not really. What saves you is the first of all, knowledge of what is going on. It's not knowledge. It's not just as simple as to be able to say, gee, I know that I'm full. I know that the ananda rests with me. Why does my mind go out there? If that's a question, there's a doubt. Say if you ask, why does my mind go out there to become happy? Are you asking that because you don't know? If you don't know, that's very important. It's very important to know why your mind goes out there. To know the whole psychodynamics. To know the whole history. To understand the mechanics of why the mind goes out there. Why is ananda projected onto the world? Why is your ananda projected onto an object? Do you know that? You need to be very clear on it. Just the relationship. It's all part of the teaching. This is all part of viveka. It's all to just say, you know, bring your mind back. Bring your mind. When your mind goes out there, bring it back.
No.
You have to understand how your mind has been duped into thinking that the ananda is external. What is it that happens? You have to see it very clearly. You have to see that I have a feeling, I believe that this object will make me happy. I've had experiences of it working before. I've seen it make other people happy, you know. And so I think it'll make me happy too. It made me happy before. Now you have to be able to say, and I know exactly why I believe that. It's because, since I thought it would make me happy, because of any number of reasons, when I fulfill the desire for that moment, my mind relaxes. When my mind relaxes, there's no tension in the mind. And the Ananda that I am reflects in the mind. I have to know that. It's not a little thing to know that. Because then what happens is you understand the mechanics of your behavior. You understand what's really going on. When you understand that, you can say, that's right, and you can pull yourself back. And then you can also allow yourself to enjoy these objects that you enjoy. You'll still always have likes and dislikes. You can allow those objects to be there, but you can pull your mind back from what we call the sneha. Sneha means this strong attachment. You can love an object, you can like an object, you can enjoy an object, or person, or situation. And like the helium balloon, when the balloon breaks loose, you can also enjoy it going. You can let it go. Why can you let it go? Because you've seen over and over and over again that the ananda that you're experiencing has to do with your relaxed mind and not with the object. You see that it's a mechanic. I call it, when I'm teaching at CIS, I call it the psychodynamics of the mind in relationship to happiness. So all of these things, you need the mind, your own mind, has to work its way through all of this to understand it, you know, so that your mind sees it. Over and over again, you see the truth of it. And then, when your mind is being drawn away by these very, very strong senses, you can appreciate the trip. You can appreciate the whole ride. And then you can also bring your mind back. Because you know what's happening and you know that your being's not at stake. But if you don't think it through, if you don't know, if you don't understand, then your mind will take you on a ride because you don't have the knowledge available, you know, to use to rein it in. Now, it's the same in terms of the same type of reining in, because behind the mind is the very, I don't want to use the word behind, the one who's the very self of your mind, the stable being that is never changing, that no matter whether you're having a sukha vritti or dukkha vritti, happy or sad, whether you're just perceiving the world, doesn't make any difference. Yourself is there, the constant. Is it true or not? Gee, in teaching they're saying that the self is constant. That's an interesting idea. It's not an idea. It's not just an idea. It's the fact of it. And so say this is unfolded time and time again to make you recognize the invariable presence of you. The invariable presence of you. The one that never modifies, never changes, never becomes more, and never becomes less. Never becomes happier, never becomes sadder. Never becomes more present or less present. Right? It's like, if we use an example, clay pot, the clay doesn't become, you know, more present in the pot or less present in the pot. It can't. It can't become more present. It can't become less present. Because it's not part of the pot, it is the pot. So it's the clay is invariable there. It can't become more into focus or less into focus. It is. Like that, you, the me, your own presence, it can't become less, it can't become more. It can't be more of an experience than it is. It is already wholly, fully, absolutely present as me. This is the me that I have to recognize. It matters not what the experience is. That's why when we want to recognize I am the whole, first of all, let me recognize that I am the whole of this room. If you can recognize I am the whole of this room, or I can even take it less than that. Can you recognize, we can start here. I like the word invariable. I am the invariable whole of this mind. of my thoughts. That's the easiest one to recognize. I am the invariable whole of my mind. What does it mean? It means I am the self of the mind. No matter what is going on in the mind, no matter what the scenery is, I am the whole, I am the truth, I am the self of the mind. And I am the invariable whole of the mind, because I can watch your thoughts come and go and I don't. The mind is a great place to start, to meditate on, to just sit with your mind and say, I am the invariable whole of my mind. There's no matter what it does, no matter what it feels, no matter what the thoughts are, I am the invariable whole. There is no place, whether I'm looking at what's on the top of the thought or the bottom of the thought, the right of the thought to the left of the thought, whether the next thought, next thought, next thought. I am the invariable whole. I never change. This is a wonderful meditation. And then from there you can go to this body. I am the invariable whole of this body. I am present. I am the Dehi. I am the indweller of this body. There's no part of this body that is away from me. This is my body. It's made of many, countless parts. But I am the being of this body. I am the self-evident being of this body, every part of it. And there are many, many parts. That there are many, many parts here doesn't bother me. I don't care if there's a billion, trillion cells. They're still all me. I am the whole. In reference to this body, that's also a given for us. Every Ajnani knows it. Right? You say, every Ajnani knows it, and I can say, and they're ignorant. It's true, they're ignorant in one way. In another way, not ignorant at all. Not at all. You know, because the truth of it is, as Brahman, the me that I am the invariable whole of this body. And the conscious being, the self-evident existence that this body enjoys as me, is the truth. That is the truth. The self-evident being that the mind enjoys is me, that is the truth. So you can start with your mind and then recognize the self-evident me that this body enjoys. That is Brahman. And then allow this body to be part of this creation, which it is. This body exists in this room. These sense organs exist in this room. Right? And the same sense organs that are perceiving this body are perceiving this room. That's how come I can have a thought modification of this room. And so, in fact, relax and notice. I am the invariable conscious being of this room. In fact, it is your experience. For the being and conscious, the conscious being, there is no object that you're looking at. It is the very being of the room. The being that is me is the being of the room. And if I knock down the walls of the room, then the being that is me is the being of the Berkeley or whatever. There's no limit to that being that I am because I'm not an object. I'm not an object in the creation. And so this, I need to use my mind. I need to use my mind to recognize this. Not shut the mind off or turn it off. We can do that in meditation, but in meditation we are not turning the mind off. In meditation, we're just letting the mind be with the truth of my being. That's not turning the mind off. I have to be able to recognize here that I am all of this. My mind needs to think it through. So that, when my mind, out of a fit of ajnana, a fit of prior conditioning, all of a sudden I become this jiva and I want that so that I can be happy. My knowledge, my buddhi, my knowledge, my clarity can say it's okay. And bring the mind back. What brings the prasabham, that very, very strong indriyas that take the mind away, what brings the mind back is strong knowledge. What is strong knowledge? Clarity. Understanding. Seeing. Not belief. It's not belief doesn't... Belief, this can be helpful. It can help you a little bit. Make things a little bit better. But that's not a solution. The strong, you could say, it's my mithyajnanam, mithyajnanam, my false knowledge that takes the mind away, you know, and it's my jnanam that brings it back. Mithyajnanam, jnanam. Okay? The jnanam has to remove that ajnanam, so the mithyajnanam doesn't have any strength. This is another thing we have to understand, why your knowledge, your clarity is so important here. When we use the example of the rope snake, that's the famous example we said all the time, rope snake. When you gain knowledge of the rope, the snake goes away, right? Now you've got a rope there, the snake's disappeared on you. So you don't have to worry about seeing the snake anymore. Because the snake's gone. And the rope is not going to generate the emotions of the snake or the relationship of the snake. Because the snake's gone. So that, it's a beautiful example of how knowledge, you know, totally, when knowledge removes the ignorance and the effects of ignorance, when the effects of ignorance are your own projection. Like I projected the snake, my friend didn't. Right? So when I get knowledge of that rope, I'm home free. You know, maybe if it was really bad, I might have to go back and check one more time. Probably not. Okay? But here, as long as when you gain self-knowledge, as long as you have this upadhi, this body, mind, sense organs that will continue until the prarabdha runs out, you'll gain knowledge that I am the whole. That there's only a graham cracker here. Right? That these nama rupas, these names and forms that we're experiencing, are nothing but being. They're nothing but my being. There's nothing. There's nothing here but my being. Just like the clay pot, there's nothing there but clay. There's nothing here but me. I am the very being of it all. I have to. Okay, so say I gain that knowledge very, very clearly. I see it. I recognize it. But I still have eyes. I still have ears. I still have a mind. The upadhi is all here functioning very well. And so now, in spite of my knowing, I continue to see. In spite of my knowing, I continue to experience. And so therefore, my knowledge and my understanding becomes very, very important. An example they use, just to understand, when you see the sunrise, and then you learn that it's not rising, somebody can just say, you know, it's not rising. You're seeing it as rising, but it's not rising. Is that enough? You see the sunrise, it's not rising. You need to understand that. Because it's going to continue rising. Right? Yeah. Right? So you need to understand. So here we can say, this is mithya, this is maya, there's nothing here but the atma. But the atma, the self, the brahman, the speed that you are, is not going to all of a sudden become an object in the creation. It's the self of the creation. I am the being which this creation enjoys. So now I have to be able to, my mind has to be able to distinguish, differentiate in this experience that I'm having of this room right now. My mind needs to be able to recognize the changeless and the changing, the me, the non-objectifiable, self-evident, conscious presence that is not an object, but which is the very being of all of the objects that I experience. Now, I need to be able to recognize a couple of things here. I have to have, through viveka, been able to sort out, differentiate the changeless conscious being that everything in this perception enjoys right now. This changeless conscious being, I need to be able to differentiate it from the names and forms that I'm seeing to see that it's the very stuff of all of this. And I need to also intellectually understand that these objects that I'm perceiving through my sense organs have no substance away from the being that is me. That they have no separate substance. I have to intellectually understand that, logically understand it, so that I understand irrefutably that there is no such thing in reality as an object in the creation. It's impossible in any form for you to find any object or anything that we could say exists in this creation. Because by the very nature of change and by the very nature of time and space itself, everything is infinitely divisible. Everything comes and goes. You can't find a substance here, and yet there's nothing but substance. The substance is non-objectifiable. There's nothing that's away from it. So I have to understand all of this. You know, I have to understand my experience. I have to be able to understand the logic of why it is like that, why it can't be another way. Otherwise, because this is what's so important about what Krishna is saying here, and Shankara addresses it, Swamiji addresses it. The sense organs are strong. The sense organs are strong. Even for the vipassajit, even for the person who knows. And so, this mind you have to bring back. The sense organs you have to continue to bring back until you don't bring them back. You have to bring them back anymore. How do you bring them back? He says in the next verse, we'll do it next week. How, but just to tell you, how do you bring them back? By having the mind sit in me alone. So he'll go on and on, but what does it mean to have the mind sit in me? Matparaha. Asita matparaha. The mind has to sit in me where I am. The matparaha. Matparaha means I means the paramatma. Right? I am the focus for that person. The mind has to sit there with intent on seeing that. Until the mind doesn't see anything else. Really, until the mind doesn't see anything else. When it sees something else, then I'm a jiva, different from you. I should be able to sit here and see all of you, and not see anything else. See. So, let's stop there.
Gosh.
Purnamada, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate,
Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Also something that you mentioned in those interviews with Swamiji, and that is like, okay, so I can see that this is just being here. No object is being. And it's anantam, because if that's all there is, then it's wonderful. But then the consciousness, you know, because in the interviews with Swamiji, you said it's very easy to see that in relation to the mind, you know. But that, so that's a little bit of a an issue, I guess.
Is the issue the relationship between existence and consciousness, or?
Well, I mean, just in terms of like, you are the whole.
Uh-huh.
Like in terms of my mind, in terms of the vrittis or something, or it's like, yeah, I can. Maybe it's still a question of Dehatma Buddhi, because I can say yes, I am an existent conscious being, and yes, this is all being. So there can only be one being.
Oh.
My being, which is anantam, because there isn't anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The consciousness.
How can... Oh, I think maybe I think so. Consciousness and existence are one and the same thing. Okay. Okay. Something that sometimes can get a little bit in the way, so I'll just put this on the side just in case, is that attributing knowership to consciousness. You know, because then we think, well, in terms of the mind is known. But consciousness isn't performing an act of knowing. So I've started liking to just say self-evident being. Now, if you say self-evident being, it kind of takes away this idea of being conscious of something. You know, I'm just self-shining. I am. And that amness is self-evident, which is why we say it is conscious. So the consciousness and the amness are one and the same thing. Now, why do the consciousness and the being have to be one and the same? It's because neither one are objectifiable. Right? So if you want to discover, it works more easily like this, I think. If you want to discover, well, what really is the nature of existence? So we start there. What really is the nature of existence? Because we experience the creation exists, right? We experience that. Everything exists. So what really, we can ask the question, what really is the nature of this existence that every object, everything enjoys? And we'll say, well, this existence that everything across the board on every level enjoys can't really belong to the name and form, because name and form comes in and out of existence. And nothing that is really can come from non-existence or go out of existence. Right? So these names and forms that all of these things enjoy, they all enjoy existence, but they themselves can't have the existence because existence doesn't come and go and they do. Right? And so we think, okay, what? I exist also as a jiva. Here I am. I'm a name and form. I exist. So let me try to find in this one nama rupa what is really the existence. And so this is where we do something like the drikdrisha viveka, the seer seen, by anything that has a form and comes and changes and the existent being remains, right, then that's not the existence per se. And so everything gets objectified, everything as a name and form, except for consciousness. Consciousness can't be objectified. And so what you're left with as the nature of existence is consciousness. So the nature of existence is consciousness. The nature of consciousness is existence, because That's the only thing which is that's not subject to objectification, not subject to change. So sat is chit, chit is sat. And we say that they are ananta, sat and chit are ananta, limitless, because they're not objectifiable to put a form around them. Okay, so now let's look at this. Okay, we see that existence is chit, is consciousness. That there is no, they're just not two things, they're only one thing. Now if I look, though, in this creation, do I see existence and consciousness as two separate things? And I'll say initially, yes, in this way. The rug only exists. This only exists. The table only exists. It's not conscious. But human beings are conscious. Plants are conscious. Animals are conscious. Right? And so some things in this creation enjoy consciousness and existence. Some only enjoy existence. Right? So based upon the upadis, based upon the creation, my mind naturally makes that kind of a distinction. And I also will say, you know, I am a conscious being and that isn't. So now I'll have subject-object relationship in this creation, all from the standpoint of the upadis, the bodies, the sentient beings and the insentient beings, the humans and the animals and the rocks and the tables, etc. Right? So now existence and consciousness have become divided. Right? So I'll say it's now, because they've become divided, some things enjoy existence, some things enjoy existence and consciousness. Now that I've divided existence and consciousness based on the upadis, now what happens is that I can say, well, I can see clearly that I, the conscious being, am the whole in reference to my mind, because the whole mind enjoys consciousness, right? Whole mind enjoys consciousness, so I, who am consciousness, can easily say I am the whole in reference to the mind, because I'm directly experiencing that the whole mind enjoys consciousness. But I can't say that I am this room. Why not? Why not? Why can't you say that? Actually, I'm really wondering why you can't. No, really. The subject-object relationship that we have is so strong, the seer-seen, seer-seen, seer-seen. What has to happen for you is that the seer and the seen have to be seen as being objects of consciousness. Right? The seer and the seen. Now look, what happens when we do that is right now, if I just look out at the room, I can say all of these objects enjoy existence. Clear? Everything that I'm perceiving enjoys existence. And I can also say everything that I'm perceiving, we're each talking from our own standpoint, everything that I'm perceiving enjoys knownness. Right? It does. It all enjoys existence. It all enjoys knownness. I might as well say it all enjoys existence. It all enjoys consciousness. It doesn't enjoy consciousness as the seer. It enjoys consciousness as the seen. Is that right? Whatever you're seeing now, everything in your perception right now enjoys existence. It is, it is, it is, it is. You take it for granted, in fact. It enjoys existence and it enjoys being seen. So I'll say it enjoys existence. It enjoys consciousness. Consciousness in what form? Consciousness as being an object of knowledge. It's seen. Okay, so now what we have to do is say, okay, everything in this room enjoys existence and consciousness equally. There's no difference between one thing being seen and another. The whole thing is being seen. Now we have to say, the problem that for me now is that I'm not included in this perception. I'm the seer. and you're the seeing. So what I have to be able to see that I am the conscious being that illumines the seer and the seen. That I am the consciousness of the seer and I am the consciousness of the seen. Right? And actually, what do you need to do then? Well, you have to see, okay, this body is seen like your body is seen. My sense organs are seen like your sense organs are seen. The thoughts in my mind are seen like the thoughts in your mind are seen. Everything is seen, in fact. We have a seer-seen differentiation within the creation. But actually, everything is seen. The seer and the seen are seen. The seer and the seen. So we have seer consciousness, seen consciousness. Right? We have seer existence, seen existence. There is nothing that's away from consciousness, in fact. Like, if I say, look at, if I say like this, this is where the error comes in. If I say to all, you are all seen consciousness. Is that okay? Can I say that? Because you're all seen, that means you're all in consciousness as seen. Seen.
Okay.
Is it all right? Okay, you're all seen consciousness. I'm the seer consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm the seer consciousness, you're the seen consciousness. Okay. So now there's a seer consciousness and a seen consciousness. But there's no divide between consciousness. I can even say there's the seer consciousness, the seen consciousness, and the seen consciousness. So consciousness is there as the invariable. The problem is, does the consciousness that's there as the invariable only belong to me? As the seer? Or does the consciousness which is here as the invariable, is it the truth of the seer and the seen? For me to really see it as the truth of the seer and the seen, I have to recognize that this body, mind, sense organs are part of the seen. And let them all be part of the seen, and then from within the seen, we're seeing. From within the scene, of which all the jivas, here we are in this room, all of us in this room are seen. Every one of us. All of the sense organs are seen, and just in the room. All of the minds are seen, just in the room. Okay? So this is all the seen consciousness. Now, in this scene, the scene of the room, all right, there's all this seeing going on. All the eyes are seeing, all the ears are hearing, all of the senses of touch are feeling. So all of this activity is going on, the seeing activity. Is the seeing activity that's going on seen? It is seen. So, the seeing also is seen. The seeing is seen, the hearing. So I'm the seer of the, you know, I'm the seer of the seer, Kano Upanishad, I'm the hearer of the hearing. I'm the conscious being. I am the conscious being, you know, which is the very truth of this entire manifestation, whether it's seen consciousness, or seer consciousness. It makes no difference. The consciousness is the same, and the consciousness is not seeing anything. The consciousness is just consciousness. It's the seer from the standpoint of the mind. It's the seer from the standpoint of the eyes. It's the hearer from the standpoint of the ears. It's the object from the standpoint of the object. But I myself, I'm not doing anything. I'm just simply the truth of the whole thing. And so this has to be differentiated.
And how do we know there's not two of these?
Because not objectifiable. If you, for there to be two, you have to exist in space. You have to exist within time and space. Right? If you don't exist within time and space as an object, what's to divide you? So I'm over here, I'm here and you're over there. According to what? According to space, which is an object. Right? according to the body. So with time and space, there can be two. But if you're the self of time and space belong to the creation, then there can't be two of the conscious being that is the very substrate conscious self of the creation. So we can be dual where there's duality. Two bodies, two minds.
Yeah. Two experiences.
Two ahankaras. Ahankara is just a thought.
But that isn't me.
No, it's just like if I hang up a little tag that says lamp. This is a lamp. Those are words that are denoting this. The ahankara that just says I am, is denoting me. It's a thought that denotes me. Yeah? I am.
Yeah? Names, you write.
Names.
Name and form, that's how it happens.
Yeah.
It's like a different question on the on the when you speak, you know, we talk all the time of the psychodynamics of the mind when you were talking about it, really the recognition that it's not an external desire satisfied that makes you happy, it's the processes that the external desire satisfied makes the mind not seek, and a relaxed mind, so the mind is relaxed. And so the last step, when we say the relaxed mind reflects myself, I've always had some sort of, you know, can we put that another way? There's something almost artificial about it, which seems to be that myself holds something that reflects on the mind, and you know, it makes
I do know. I don't like the language either. It's tricky, and there's a twofold trickiness to it. I think if you let the words and the unfoldment point to the actual experience, that's about the best they can do. But let me look at the twofold trickiness. First of all, it's not like the sun reflecting in a water bucket. Here's the sun and here's the water bucket, or, you know, that sun reflecting in a mirror where there's some sort of a distance. And then there's this reflection that's giving an experience, as though the experience is the reflection. That's a problem. So, but now here, but there's some truth in it too. Truth is this: when your mind is relaxed, there are degrees of relaxation and degrees of experience of ananda. Right? So you can be, your mind can have, be a little bit happy, can be more happy, it can be really, really happy. So it's gradiated. And on the other side, it can be kind of unhappy to absolute hell. So the mind can take you from heaven to hell. And we say, really, as a teaching device, when your mind is happy, having the experiences of happiness, at that time it's at peace. It doesn't want anything. Okay. And what we say is, when the mind is like that, we'll say it's reflecting the self, or it's the self is manifest in that mind. We can say like that. But it's in a sense, it's misleading. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, yourself is always present in the mind, whether the mind is happy or not. However, the mind can get into conditions that are really miserable. And when the mind is relaxed and not seeking, at that time it's at home with itself. And so it is not contributing anything other than the self. See what I mean? It's another example that they'll use is like, it becomes like a very clear, like a clear window, like a clear plate of glass. It is not contributing anything. And so the ananda that you are reflects in that mind. And now another thing. Now, why do we still say reflects? Because the condition of the sattva of the mind creates a condition of ananda that is different than the swarupa ananda of the self. So we can say the Swarupananda, the natural ananda of the self, is very much present and manifest in that mind, right? But it's manifest in the unhappy mind also, right? And so here, the mind, when it's not contributing anything of itself, anything, any emotions or any baggage of its own, it's just completely relaxed. It's not looking out for anything. Then the mind in that condition enjoys joy. Joy, okay? We say that that condition is a lakshana. Means it helps, it points to the source that is manifesting in that mental condition to cause that experience.
What?
The self is manifesting in the sattvic mind, which is at peace, right? It's manifesting in the mind when it is in that condition in such a way that we say that is bliss, ananda, joy, happiness. We have all the positive words that go to define that. Now, in that mental condition, you're at home. In other words, your mind doesn't say, well, let me get rid of that. You know, I want to be different. Your mind is at peace in that condition. Because it doesn't want to run from that condition, we say it's reflecting the self. The self resonates it in it. It's at home with the self in that condition. The trap in it, the trap of it, is to then identify the blissful conditions of the mind with the Swarupananda of the self, which is its own self-evident fullness that is not a variegated joy in the mind. But when the mind is on the positive spectrum, it feels at home and doesn't want to get away. It feels complete and whole with yourself. So we use it as a lakshana to point to what is absolutely manifest and present in that mind.
Right, but then the point is that the self is, you know, if we want to use the words, that the self is reflected in a relaxed mind, the self is really reflected to the same degree in any kind of mind.
Well, I would say no. Okay, there's a little thing there. I would say that the self is not reflected, that the self is self-evident in every mind. That's much different. So we use the word reflected to say that that mind is in a condition which enjoys the self, it feels at home, whereas we don't use the word reflected in a dukkha vritti. The mind's not reflected, the self is not reflected in a dukkha vritti. In a dukkha vritti, sorrowful vritti, we want to flee that, we want to get rid of it. So the self is not manifest, they're reflected there. Now that's different. That's using this word reflected. Now at the same time I can say the self-evident self, the Swarupananda of the self, which is the self, is absolutely present in the dukkha vritti, in the sukha vritti, in every vritti. And it doesn't become more or less. Just because you have a negative vritti, your self doesn't become sorrowful. Experientially, I mean. Your being doesn't change at all. That's why it's so important to use all of the different emotions, feelings, and experiences that you have to recognize the invariable. That when we say the invariable is self-evident, those aren't just words. It's that you are completely, wholly present in all of the experiences that you have. But the sukha, the positive experiences, reflect you. In other words, they're in harmony with you, they resonate with you, the mind doesn't want to change them. You know, it feels at home with itself.
But I don't get that. Why are the positives any better? It just feels like then it should be enough to differentiate the mind with all its positive and its negative vrittis. Once that is differentiated from the self, you know, why say, well, okay, the positive vrittis are more... they're assumptions of the mind as opposed to...
It's true, and I think that but as you become at home with your knowledge, you don't even think like that because you're there present no matter what the vritti is, and it doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
but at all. You don't even think like it. Okay, but for a teaching methodology, mm-hmm. we would rather be with the happy vrittis than the sad ones. For a student who's learning, mm-hmm. wouldn't you agree that the happy vrittis, I mean, there's a reason for the word happy and there's a reason for the word sad. Mm-hmm. People gravitate towards sukha mm-hmm. and they gravitate away from dukkha, mm-hmm. right? And so when the sukha vrittis, the happy vrittis are there, thoughts are there, I feel at home. There's always going to be fear because I'm not going to be able to keep them, but I feel at home. When the dukkha vrittis are there, I want to get rid of them. So what is the dynamics? What is going on that causes the sukha, causes the dukkha? So all of analyzing all of the experience that we have is a samsari, because it's the samsari as becomes a mumukshu. The mumukshu comes to the teaching, right? So the teacher has to use the experiences that are here to take you to the recognition of that invariable self, right? But now, when that invariable self is recognized, what is the predominance of vrittis that are there? Sukha vrittis. Why? Because I don't really want anything to be different, so there's no problem. The mind is relaxed because of the invariable nature of myself, and that becomes the home base for the mind. The wholeness that I seek, I recognize to be the very nature of my being. And that's where the attachment of the mind, what we call atma-kamaha, the one who desires the atma, right? The mind becomes an atma-kamaha. It desires the atma. When it desires the atma, there's no problem because the atma is changeless. But I can understand the problem, Kiki, because words have their limitations, and reflection is one of those very tricky words. But it's also why we go between what's called pratibimba vada. Pratibimba vada means pratibimba means reflection, right? And the avakasha, that which pervades. So just like the pot space pervades the pot, right? But then we also, or we can say the pot space pervades the pot, that's one way we deal with it. Or we go to clay pot where there's nothing, that type of pervasion, it's a different type of pervasion, clay pot versus pot space. But then we have to bring in the pratibimba vada also to make the relationship between the atma and the mind understood. Mm-hmm. Right? Then we have to, every jiva, now look at this problem, this is all for teaching. Look at this problem. Everybody wants to be happy. That we seek happiness, we're seeking wholeness. When we think of wholeness, that's just a word. We want love or happiness or wholeness or completeness. But we never say, oh, wholeness is misery. When we say wholeness, it means happiness or love or happiness. And everybody has that experience of having experiences of love or wholeness or happiness. And we all know this is what I want. This is what I'm supposed to be. This is how it's supposed to be. Where is that? You know?
And after all the deities have a smile. You know?
Yeah, and we would like to have that inner smile that we don't have to worry about losing.
Well, that was the first thing I thought. When I saw, like, probably Lord Shiva, he had this smile on his face, and I couldn't figure out where that was coming from.
Well, you know, I've been going through a lot of grief the last couple of weeks, you know, and so in between I would go like, okay, now have I changed? Have I been affected by this, you know? Crying or whatever, da da da. And I, you know, it's like I didn't get an answer. It was not like, you know, okay, the self is self-evident. So where is the self-evidence at this point? You know what I mean?
You're self-evident.
Yeah.
The one who's having the experience. But you have to, you know, if you say, You have to watch out when you say, well, like you've had an experience of grief. Mm. Usually with an experience of grief, there's a lot of love involved in the experience of grief.
Right.
And so there'll be a lot of growth and change.
So and
so,
sadness.
Yeah. But so say there's grief or sadness, but there'll be growth and change, and all kinds of things are happening when you have a profound experience like that. Right? And so in that, on the level of the mind or the psyche, there will be so much change and growth and deepening and things taking place. But the one who is present to all of that is the invariable. And so say, if in getting lost in the world, or lost in the sense of engaged in all of your experiences in the world, maybe that changeless presence gets overshadowed by your engagement in the world. And so that's why nididhyasana, or contemplation, is helpful, because it allows you throughout the day even to just come back to yourself, to recognize the presence of the one who is there lighting up. It's the very self of all of these experiences. We use meditation, that's sort of the next verse in fact. We really use meditation for the mind to over and over again get to know myself, the self that is itself, right? but to know it as the invariable, rather than to just take it for granted as part of the mental experience, of the experience of the mind, to notice that it's not just the experience of the mind, it's the changeless presence of me.
What do you mean by it's not the experience of the mind?
Well, the mind normally just identifies. So if the mind is happy, I am happy. If the mind is sad, I am sad. Right? So there, I still am the self of the mind. Right? Because even the mind says, I am happy, I am sad. I'm still the self of the mind. But the mind doesn't have any differentiation. It doesn't recognize that I am illumining, I am the very invariable presence in the sad mind and the invariable presence in the happy mind. I am the invariable presence in the grieving mind and the invariable presence in the growing mind. And so if the mind is just taking that presence for granted, which is the samsari's condition, it just takes it for granted as belonging to itself. It hasn't recognized the invariable. Say it recognizes the invariable, then it doesn't. Then you just bring it back to your own presence, the changelessness
of
your own presence.
Of the growth of the psyche in the grief process. There's a growth in the psyche.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of love in it, like you said. I think that's what kind of distracted me.
Yeah, and you're probably be very profound experience.
And I thought that was the self or something like that.
No, that's the mind that is in having a profound experience.
Yeah,
like
you're very busy with that experience.
It's also very contemplative. Mm. You know, if you're using it that way, which you were. So.
When you sit and contemplate the teaching, it seems like it's sort of like the wise part of the mind or the buddhi that's contemplating. But you know how you say that all parts of the mind sort of have to mature and own up to it?
Mm-hmm.
When you sit, does that bring in the other parts of the mind on its own, or do you kind of have to consciously work with the immature parts of the mind?
I know exactly what you mean. That's why, you know, when we do the contemplation, haven't done it the last few times, but often we ask, does anybody have anything to say inside? As you have that integrated as part of the contemplation, so all of those parts get a chance to talk to you, and they can also pray. Say, does anybody want to tell Bhagavan anything? If you say, if included in your contemplation, if there's any prayer, if you include the all of the different parts of the psyche to see if anybody has anything to say, if anybody anything bothering anyone. You could say, I'm going to pray to Bhagavan. Does anybody have anything, any prayers you want to say? So that they're integrated, so they're very much involved and very much part of you in your inner relationship, and that they're part of the in the relationship with Ishwar also. That's very important, actually. It should be part of a meditative process that they're included, and that also, I like the way you said this other thing too, that when you're meditating, the buddhi, one who has the knowledge, is the deepest part of yourself is meditating. Right? And it's that one also that can be so comforting to the parts of yourself that need, that are insecure, or they have this problem or that problem or want this, or, you know. But buddhi is the one that can come and take care of all those other parts. And it's your buddhi that would say, does anybody have anything to say, or somebody, some part of you has a real problem, something bothering or hurting, then it's that buddhi that is available to listen and to help. That's really the inner friend, you know, and that is the one that raises up all of these parts of the psyche. It's a very beautiful process. And this also is knowledge, right? It's knowledge of how to be with your mind, and understanding that whole process, so that your buddhi, your mind, you have the knowledge to even know how to do that. That's a great thing to even know to do that, mm-hmm. and then to practice it, so that you know all of those parts. Once you practice it, all those inner parts will hear you. They'll be so thank you. You know. So yeah, it's so important. And say with a grief experience, you may be feeling, the adult you has one view, the Vedanta you has one view, mm-hmm. but the child has another view. So many parts, and all of them need to be comforted at their own age level, you know, and understood at their age level. You don't want to make a little 6-year-old into a, you know, 30-year-old. They need to be comforted in the way that they need to be comforted. You know. And so treat the parts inside of you like you would treat the ones outside, in the best of all possible worlds. And your best behavior, how would you treat others out here? Best behavior in the way that you would love to treat others out here. Or love to treat your children, that way you treat the parts inside. Oh, it makes such a difference.
Very soothing.